I forgot to mention that actually the armor of God was the theme for the classes this year for our Sabbath school. So the perfect song for them to finish up the year with. And again, thanks to all the instructors and the parents and the children for your part in this year's Sabbath school program. A couple of weeks ago, the last time we were here, I started a series of sermons on the origins of the political crisis in the Middle East. It's always a location where there is tension, where there is the possibility of an outbreak of violence. At the moment, people's attention is focused more on the war in Ukraine, but the Middle East is always a hotbed. At this moment, there's no immediate disruption there, but the entire region is kind of like a can of gasoline sitting next to a bonfire. It won't take much of a spark to have explosive and disastrous results and effects. Let's turn to begin back to Matthew chapter 24. Pick up a couple of verses here. Matthew chapter 24. I want to read verses 15 and 16. Matthew 24, verse 15. These are the words of Jesus as he's speaking to his disciples. They'd asked him for the sign of what would be his return and the end of this age. He first of all listed a series of trends and events that would take place over a period of time that he called the beginning of sorrows. And then he got down to the description of the end of the age. Verse 15, he says, "When you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains." Whoever reads, let him understand, is certainly a key to this statement. Because many people would read right over this or look at circumstances as they developed and not have an understanding of what it means, of what the significance is. But this event, which will take place in Jerusalem, it says that this takes place at the holy place. This will be a trigger event that will lead to a whole series of events culminating in what Jesus called the Great Tribulation. Verse 21, "For then will be great tribulation, such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be." Think about what that means. There's been so much disaster, so much chaos, so much turmoil and pain in the past. This will overshadow anything that has ever happened before. And it's triggered by something called the abomination of desolation in the holy place. The holy place, of course, is a part of the temple where the sacrifices were made. And so there are some implications here that are very important, because what, some 30, 40 years after this prophecy was given in Matthew 24, the temple was destroyed. And ever since then, there has not been a sacrificial system, because the altar was not there for them to use. So this implies then that there will, at the very least, at the end of the age, when this begins to occur, a location where the sacrifices can be resumed and the Levitical priesthood can be active once again. So something is going to happen before and leading up to this time of the abomination of desolation, so that those events can take place. So it actually implies a whole series of events that are going to occur. Verse 32. Verse 32. As Jesus is giving this description of events that would lead to his return, he says, "Learn this parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth leaves, you know that summer is near. So you also, when you see all these things, know that it, that is the end of the age, the return of Jesus Christ, the time of the great tribulation, know that it is near, even at the doors. So there are things that we can be aware of, that we need to watch for, that will indicate that these events are coming about or about to come about. We need to understand, as we read, we need to understand. And one other thought I'll pick up from verse 25. Matthew 24, verse 25. After describing this time of great tribulation, the confusion that will come through false teachers in that same period of time, Jesus concludes this section by saying, "Look or see, I have told you beforehand." Jesus said, "Look, I've told you what is going to happen." And he certainly is going to hold us to that, that he's warned what the events will be. And it's kind of like before it even happens, he's already saying, "I told you so." He's warned us that these things are going to happen. So it's important for us to have understanding of what events are taking place, what they mean as they unfold, and what they will lead to. And this event will take place in Jerusalem, right in the heart of the Middle East. So once again, let's back up a couple of steps and ask, why is there so much tension in that part of the world? Why are all those nations and the people that are in that part of the world unable to come to some kind of a peaceful agreement so they can at least live with one another without all these hostilities? Well, to get perspective on how things will come about, I've offered that we need to go back and look at the early history of this area. Look at the history of the people who inhabit this part of the world and examine how it came to be in the condition that it is in. To briefly summarize what we talked about last time, the area of Canaan, which is where Jerusalem is, was initially populated by two of Noah's sons and their descendants, Ham and Shem. Ham was the ancestor of all the Ites, the Hivites, all the Ites that were the Canaanites that lived in that region were descended from Ham. And they're listed in Genesis chapter 10, verse 16. These are the Canaanites who lived in the area of Canaan, the area that God had promised Abraham his descendants would inherit. We also read or saw how that Abraham's first son, Ishmael, was prophesied to become a great nation and great numbers of people, but the promised greatness would not go to Ishmael, it would go through Abraham's second son, Isaac. And Ishmael would be on the fringes, on the edges, and not really able to enjoy the great blessings that God would bring through Isaac. The Canaanites and the family of Ishmael have deep roots in Canaan. They began to dwell in this land some 900 years before Israel came into Canaan. They were deeply established. They had almost 1,000 years of history, of culture. And the Israelites were to come in and remove them and to take over the land that they had developed. Certainly the stage was set from the beginning for conflict in that part of the world. So today as we continue, we're going to focus on the development of Abraham's family. The title of the sermon this afternoon is The Peoples of the Middle East. It's the second in the series, which I've titled The Origins of the Middle East Crisis. This sermon in particular, The Peoples of the Middle East. So let's do a little survey and review how they came to be in this area and who they are. We'll start in Genesis 19. Genesis 19. We're kind of backing up a little bit from where we left off last time. But in Genesis 19, we find that after Abraham had been pleading with the angels who were sent to destroy Sodom, that they agreed to rescue Lot and his family from Sodom before they destroyed it. There weren't enough people there to spare the city, so Lot, his wife and daughters, were to be rescued, and other members of his family too. Lot was reluctant because his other daughters and sons-in-law were not willing to come out of Sodom with him and his wife and his two younger daughters. But they were finally coaxed out of the city before it was destroyed. Verse 24 says, "The Lord rained brimstone and fire on Sodom and Gomorrah from the Lord out of the heavens. He overthrew the cities, all the plain, all the inhabitants of the cities, and what grew on the ground. He thoroughly scorched Sodom, the sister city Gomorrah, and all the areas surrounding it." Verse 26, "But his wife looked back behind him, and she became a pillar of salt." Now, she didn't just glance back over her shoulder to see what the commotion was. She obviously longed to be part of Sodom. That was where she wanted to be. She didn't want to be rescued. She didn't want to be brought into a place where she would live a different kind of life. She wanted Sodom. And she, her life ended in that way. She became a pillar of salt. So this led us to a very desperate decision that his daughters made. Again, now, the only survivors from those cities were Lot and his two daughters. They were all that came out of the city. Verse 30, "Lot went up out of Zoar and dwelt in the mountains with his two daughters with him. He was afraid to dwell in Zoar, so they dwelt in a cave." Verse 31, "Now the firstborn daughter said to the younger, 'Our father is old, and there's no man on the earth to come into us, as is the custom of all the earth.'" They had no hope whatsoever of marriage and family. Verse 32, "Come, let us make our father drink wine, and we will lie with him that we may preserve the lineage of our father." Pretty much a perfect example of human reasoning, of twisted human reasoning. But they felt the only way for them to preserve their family line was to become pregnant by their father and to bear children in his name. Verse 36, "Both the daughters of Lot were with child by their father. The firstborn bore a son and called his name Moab. He's the father of the Moabites to this day. And the younger also bore a son and called his name Ben-Ammi. He is the father of the people of Ammon to this day." The reason we mention this twisted circumstance is because it adds to the mix of the people who populated this region of the world. The Moabites and the Ammonites began here in this odd, perverted relationship. The Moabites and the Ammonites were enemies of Israel. And so we add them to the mix of the people that we see gathering or being drawn together in this part of the world that will result in all the conflict that will come about. So with that in mind, we continue on with the story. Let's skip ahead to chapter 22. Chapter 22. This is a pivotal moment in history. Abraham had already sent away his son Ishmael. As I commented last time, Ishmael, by this time, when Isaac was born, was 13 years of age, and when he was sent away from the family, he would have been 16 years of age. Certainly, Abraham had a loving relationship with his son Ishmael. And for some 13 years, he thought that Ishmael was going to be the one who would be the heir, the one who would receive those promises that God made would come through his descendant, his son Ishmael. But God told him, no, it would be by a son born to him and Sarah. And so it was Isaac who would be that son of promise. By the time we get to chapter 22, Ishmael has been sent away, a sad and difficult time, but a decision that Abraham was willing to make. And now we find yet another incredible test of his faith and his obedience. He already lost his first son, Ishmael, and now he's been told to sacrifice his other son, his only son, or the one son that was to be the son of his inheritance, he was told to sacrifice him. When he proved that he was willing to do so, God said that he now understood and saw the character that Abraham had. Verse 12, God intervened and said, "Do not lay your hand on the lad or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." He referred to Isaac as his only son. He was the son through whom God was going to bring about his promises that were made to Abraham's descendants. And as a result of Abraham's faithfulness and his commitment and his obedience, God made a covenant with Abraham, binding it by swearing by himself that he would bless Abraham and his descendants. You read that in verses 15 through 18, where the promises made to Abraham now are bound by the very word of God, by him swearing by his own name that he would bless Abraham's descendants in this special way. So that was a pivotal point, a turning point, an important part of the development of Abraham's family. Verse 20 in this chapter gives us a little bit of important background that's going to come into play very soon. Verse 20 says, "It came to pass after these things that it was told Abraham that indeed Milcah also has borne children to your brother Nahor." Remember, Abraham had two brothers, Haran and Nahor. Haran had died while he was still in Babylon. Nothing much is said about Nahor when the rest of the family moved to the area of Haran. But here we find that Nahor has been there all along, and he has a family as well. And verse 23 says that one of his sons, Bethuel, begot Rebekah. So Rebekah is a part of the family here of Abraham through his brother, Nahor. Nahor's eight sons, has eight sons, and one of them has a daughter named Rebekah. So we see another piece of the puzzle starting to come together for Abraham's family. In chapter 23, we'll just skip over this for now, we read of the death of Sarah. Sarah died at 127 years of age, and she was buried in a cave that Abraham bought from one of the local Canaanites. Chapter 24. After Sarah has died, it says in verse 1 that Abraham was old, well advanced in age, and the Eternal had blessed Abraham in all things. So Abraham said to the oldest servant of his house, who ruled over all that he had, "Please put your hand under my thigh, and I'll make you swear by the Eternal, the God of heaven and the God of earth, that you will not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites." This was a very special form of a promise or a vow that he made, that, and solemnly to Abraham, that he would be sure that his son Isaac would not marry a Canaanite woman. But it says, "You shall go to my country and to my family and take a wife for Isaac, my son." God intended that the family of Abraham would remain separate from all the other peoples in Canaan. His family would maintain a direct line. It would not become, not allow any of the Canaanites or others in the area to become part of that line of his family. His promises were to be fulfilled by the direct descendants of Isaac, not to be mixed with any of the other peoples in the land. Verse 34, we find that the servant is able to complete the task that he was sent to do. After meeting Rebekah, he meets the family. In verse 34, he says, "I am Abraham's servant. The Eternal has blessed my master greatly. He has become great. He has given him flocks and herds and silver and gold and servants and camels and donkeys. And Sarah, my sister's wife, bore a son to my master when she was old, and to him he has given all that he has. Now my master has made me swear, saying, 'You shall not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites, in whose land I dwell, but you shall go to my father's house and to my family and take a wife for my son." So the servant introduces the family to his request, to his mission, that he would find a daughter from Abraham's from his family to bring back to marry his son Isaac. In verse 50, Laban, that's Rebecca's brother, and Bethuel, her father, answered and said, "The thing comes from the Eternal. We cannot speak to you either good or bad." They're not going to judge this situation, but they know that it came from God, and so they were willing to go ahead with and to fulfill the request. "Here is Rebecca before you. Take her and go, and let her be your master's son, your master's son's wife, as the Eternal has spoken." And then a little later in verses of the last couple of verses of the chapter, we find that Rebecca herself agrees with and is willing to go with the servant to become Isaac's wife. Again, very important step in the development of Abraham's family was that Isaac would marry within the family and that the line of Abraham would continue not having any other, the Canaanites or any of the other inhabitants of the land in the family lineage. Chapter 25, interesting development. It says in verse 1 that Abraham took a wife. Her name was Keturah, and she bore him, this list of six names is given here. After having Isaac, Abraham took a wife, and her name was Keturah, and by her he has six more sons. It says that it lists their names, and then verse 5, it says that Abraham gave all that he had to Isaac. So this was kind of a different, maybe kind of an odd family dynamic. Keturah was obviously not of his family. Was she a Canaanite or one of the families of the land is not clear. But Abraham was going to be sure that the inheritance that he was to give would all go to Isaac. As his other sons came along, it says in verse 6, Abraham gave gifts to the sons of the concubines, which Abraham had, and while he was still living, he sent them eastward, away from Isaac, his son, to the country of the east. So as Abraham has more sons, he, as they grow up, he wants them to not be a part of anything that is given to Isaac, and so he sends them away, gives them gifts, gets them set up, and he sends them away to the east toward Babylon, or toward in at least into the desert east of Canaan. Now, it says in verse 7 that Abraham died at the age of 175. Sarah died when he was 137, so that puts 38 years between the time that that Sarah died and the time that Abraham died. When you look at the numbers, it seems likely that the marriage to Keturah overlapped with the marriage to Sarah. Otherwise, these six sons would have been awfully young when he sent them off on their own. Be that as it may, the point is that here's more to be added to the line or the lineage of Abraham. You have Ishmael, and now you have these other six sons, all direct descendants of Abraham, but they are not born of the family of Abraham, and they are not going to take part in the inheritance that is going to be reserved for Isaac and his descendants. The sons of Keturah are mentioned briefly in 1 Chronicles chapter 1. It gives a brief genealogy of those six sons in verses 31 through 33 in 1 Chronicles chapter 1. So what we're seeing as we continue is, again, an accumulation of different peoples who dwell in the land of Canaan. But God is only going to make promises to one line of Abraham's family, and all the rest are scattered throughout the area and are not going to receive the inheritance and the promises that are made to Isaac's descendants. You've got the descendants of his nephew Lot, the descendants of Ishmael, and now the sons of Keturah, as well as all the Canaanite tribes that are dwelling in the land. As we see the story of Isaac unfold, we begin to see the origin of what will become the nation of Israel. Remember, I mentioned it when we first began that Genesis is about origins, it's about beginnings. And so this is going to tell the story of the beginning of the nation of Israel. We'll kind of skim through this. In chapter 25, we find that, like Sarah, Rebecca initially was barren. Verse 19 says, "This is the genealogy of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham begot Isaac. Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebecca as wife, the daughter of Bethuel, the Syrian of Padan Aram, the sister of Laban, the Syrian." Now, Bethuel and Laban are called Syrians not because of their heritage or because they were Syrian by birth, but because that's where they lived. The land north of Israel, in the area called Haran, was in the region of Syria. So they're referred to as Syrians because that's where they lived. But they were not Syrian by birth. At any rate, Rebecca, it says, verse 21, Isaac pleaded with the Lord for his wife because she was barren, and the Lord granted his plea, and Rebecca, his wife, conceived. So initially, she was not able to bear children, but was healed and became pregnant. Verse 22, "But the children struggled together within her, and she said, 'If all is well, why am I like this?'" She had a difficult pregnancy. I guess babies move, you know, when they're inside the womb, but this wasn't just natural, normal movement. There was something going on in there, and it troubled her and worried her about what was happening. So she inquired of the Lord, and he said to her, verse 23, "Two nations are in your womb. Two peoples shall be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other. The older shall serve the younger." The prophecy that the older would serve the younger is significant. In Old Testament culture, the firstborn had a very special place in the family. The oldest son had more responsibilities, more rights, more privileges than those who were born later. The older son would receive the birthright, which was the inheritance of the family. He also was to receive a double portion of the family inheritance, along with a special blessing that would come from his father. This was the patriarch system that was part of that culture. And the responsibilities and the special privileges went to the oldest son, to the firstborn. He would become himself then the family patriarch, the head of the family. But it says in verse 24 that when her days were fulfilled to give birth, there were twins in her womb. Part of the reason why there was the struggle going on, the more movement, because there were two babies in there. They were twins. We see from the way that this unfolds that the two sons were fraternal twins. Maternal twins are identical. They share the same DNA. Fraternal twins, really, it's like two separate pregnancies taking place at the same time, because each of the babies is from a different egg. And so fraternal twins are like other siblings. They're alike in some ways, but they're not identical. They don't have the same DNA. They're not that closely similar. So it's not unusual for fraternal twins to be very different from one another. This was the case for these two sons that were born to Isaac and Rebekah. Verse 24, we read that when they were twins. Verse 25, "And the first came out red. He was like a hairy garment all over, so they named him Hairy." That's what Esau means. So their first son is Hairy, and afterward, his brother came out, and he took hold of Esau's heel. So they called him Grabby. They were struggling in the womb from the very beginning. And when they were born, the second son, they named Jacob, which means supplanter or one who struggles to replace or to overcome, came out holding the foot of his brother. They were fighting for position. And Jacob was right there, right behind Esau, struggling with him from the very beginning. And they were very different personalities and temperaments. Verse 27 says, the boys grew, and Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, but Jacob was a mild man, dwelling in tents. Esau was a skilled and cunning hunter. He loved to be out in the woods. He was a man's man. He lived in the wilderness. Jacob, it says, was mild. Now, that doesn't mean that he was a wimp. Doesn't mean that he was weak. The word mild could be translated balanced or complete. Esau, frankly, was unbalanced. You know, he'd live out in the woods and probably be gone for long periods of time, living out there on his own. Esau was very successful and very cunning, capable hunter. Jacob was just simply cunning and manipulative. And that bears out as we see the story unfold. Jacob took advantage of Esau when Esau was weakened by hunger. And we know that Jacob coerced Esau into selling him his birthright, giving up the birthright position that he had as the older son. Verse 29 of chapter 25, Jacob cooked a stew, and Esau came in from the field, and he was weary. And Esau said to Jacob, please feed me with the same red stew. I'm weary. Now, if Jacob had heard Mr. Haney's sermonette, he would have been happy just to share the stew and to make the burden of his brother a little bit lighter. But that wasn't the way Jacob was made. He wasn't wired that way. He saw an opportunity to manipulate and to take advantage, which is exactly what he did. Jacob said, sell me your birthright right now. If you want a bowl of this stew, I'll trade it to you for your birthright. Esau said, look, if I die of hunger, what good is a birthright? So yeah, he made the deal. And he swore to Jacob that day. He sold his birthright. And Jacob gave him his bowl of stew. Jacob was a manipulator. Jacob was a supplanter. He wanted to use his skill and strength to take over and to dominate, and he took advantage of Esau in this situation. Now, Esau obviously did not value his birthright. He didn't understand or see the significance or the meaning. He didn't care. Jacob saw the value of it. In chapter 27, we see that the formal blessing is also passed along to Jacob instead of to Esau. Verse 1, it came to pass when Isaac was old and his eyes were dim that he could not see, and he called Esau, his older son, and he said to him, Esau, and he said, here I am. Then he said, behold, now I'm old. I don't know the day of my death. Therefore, take your weapons, your quiver and your bow, and go out to the field and hunt game for me, and make me savory food, such as I love, and bring it to me that I might eat, that my soul may bless you before I die. He wanted Esau to use his skills as a hunter to get some fresh game, to prepare it for him for a very special meal, and then Isaac would pass on his blessing to Esau. Rebekah overheard, and they hatched a plan. She and Jacob came up with a plan for Jacob to pose as Esau and to receive the blessing that Isaac intended to give to Esau. So we see that Jacob, in a sense, has stolen the blessing from Esau. Now, technically, I'm not sure that he actually stole it, because remember, God intended for Jacob to be the dominant brother. God intended for Jacob to be the one who would receive the special blessings. He took matters into his own hands through deceit, and he took the blessing on his own effort, which caused a whole lot of complications. You'll see as the story continues. But technically speaking, the blessing and the birthright were both intended to go to Jacob in the first place. In verses 36 through 41, you find the blessing that God gave to, 27 through 29, you find the blessing that God gave to Jacob. Therefore, verse 28, may God give you of the dew of heaven, of the fatness of the earth, plenty of grain and wine, that peoples serve you and nations bow down to you. Be master over all your brethren. Let your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be everyone who curses you, and blessed be those who bless you. This sweeping blessing was given then to Jacob, although Esau thought he was giving this blessing to Esau. By the time Esau came back on the scene and found out what had happened, there really was not much left for God to, or for Isaac to share with Esau. Pick it up in verse 36, chapter 27. I'm reading from the New International here. Esau, now speaking to his father, when he found out that the birthright had been given, or the blessing had been given to Jacob, Esau said, "Isn't he rightly named Jacob? He's deceived me these two times. He took my birthright, and now he's taken my blessing." Then he asked, "Haven't you reserved any blessing for me?" Isaac answered Esau, "I've made him lord over you and have made all his relatives his servants. I have sustained him with grain and new wine. What can I possibly do for you, my son?" Esau was desperate. He said, "Father, don't you have only one blessing for me? Bless me too." And he wept. His father answered him, "Your dwelling will be away from the earth's richness, away from the dew of the heaven. You will live by the sword. You will serve your brother. But when you grow restless, you'll throw his yoke off your neck." That's not much of a blessing. There wasn't much left for Isaac to share with Esau, except to make it formal that he would be living on the edges, on the outside, very much like Ishmael. If you go back and read the prophecy that was made of Ishmael, he was to live in the vicinity of his brothers and have a hostile relationship with them. And now Esau is given the same kind of a sentence or a prophecy for his life. So Esau held a grudge against Jacob, verse 41, because of the blessing his father had given to him, to Jacob. He said to himself, "The days of mourning for my father are near, then I will kill my brother Jacob." Esau was going to off Jacob because of what he had done, because in Esau's eyes, Jacob had stolen. He certainly took it at a time that wasn't the way that God would have done so, in a way that God would never have done, but the blessing was given, the birthright was given to Jacob instead of to Esau. The situation that's developed has come about because of impatience and lack of faith of both Rebekah and Jacob. Maybe it was because primarily of Rebekah's attitude, maybe it was because of Jacob, probably a combination of the two. But Jacob, with his aggressive temperament and his mother, tricked Isaac, and the blessing and the birthright went to Jacob. So now we go through this story just again to make the point that it adds another element of instability in Canaan. Because now you have Esau and his family who are bitterly opposed to Jacob and his family. And Esau's intent was to kill his brother because of everything that had taken place, because of what Jacob had done to take advantage of him. Verse 41, again, Esau was determined to kill his brother. So his mother, being aware of this, told Jacob that he needed to get out of Dodge while he still could. She again manipulated her husband and got his involvement in sending Jacob away. First of all, to Jacob, she says, "Surely your brother Esau comforts himself." This is verse 42. "Concerning you by intending to kill you. Now therefore, my son, obey my voice and flee to my brother Laban in Haran and stay with him a few days until your brother's fury turns away." Well, I think we've all set out to do things that we thought would take a few days, that maybe stretched out to 14 years or more. Probably Jacob was in Haran with Laban and his family for more like 20 years. But it didn't blow over quickly, as Rebecca had initially hoped. He couldn't come back in just a few days. Chapter 28. "Isaac called Jacob and blessed him and charged him and said to him, 'You shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan.'" Again, very significant and important. Jacob also was not to marry into the people of the land around them. "Arise," he says, "go to Padam Aram, to the house of Bethuel, your mother's father, and take yourself a wife from there, from the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother." God is maintaining the family line of Abraham through Isaac. Jacob now is also to maintain that line of Abraham's that's not to become part of the land or the people of the land around them. Later in this same chapter, it says in verse 6 that Esau saw that Isaac had blessed Jacob and sent him away to take a wife from Padan Aram or Haran. And he blessed him and said, "You shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan." And Jacob had obeyed his father and mother and gone to Padan Aram. So Esau, verse 8, saw that the daughters of Canaan did not please his father. So Esau went to Ishmael and took Mahalath, the daughter of Ishmael. So he marries into the family, but on Ishmael's side. So it's still not going to be the same as the marriage of Jacob to his cousin, Rachel and Leah. So we find, again, we're going to wrap it up for today, but we find this mix of people that are brewing and growing and coming into the same area of Canaan. It's a very unstable place from the very beginning. Consider the people who are populating Canaan now at this time, North Africa and the Middle East in general. You have Lot's descendants, Moab and Ammon. You have the sons of Keturah. You have the family of Ishmael, and now the family of Esau, all in this same area where we're going to find the family of Jacob. Besides that, again, add in all the Canaanites, the Philistines, all the different groups that came from that are descendants of Ham. These all blend together in this land, in this area of the world. The Encyclopedia Britannica makes an interesting point. It says that the term Arab refers to, quote, "any of the inhabitants of the Arabic-speaking peoples in the vast region from the Atlantic coast of Africa to southwestern Iran, including Egypt, Sudan, the Arabian Peninsula, Syria, and Iraq." All these people, all the different blends of all the different nationalities and cultures, all the different families of Abraham and the other people mixed in, became this general mass of people called Arabs because of where they live and because of their heritage. And they're all outside of, apart from, kept away from the blessings that God is going to give to the descendants of Isaac and now of Jacob. So these all inherit the land or live in the land of Canaan. And remember, they have a 900-year head start on Israel. It's going to be the year 1403 when Israel finally enters into Canaan. So for some, almost a millennium, the nations of the people around them have dug in their roots, have established themselves. It's their land. And here comes the descendants of Abraham to claim it as the land that God promised to them. We'll continue next time. We'll look at Israel coming, the development of the nation of Israel, and how they come into the land of Canaan, and what happens at that point when they begin to take the inheritance that God has promised to them.